This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Recordings of calls made from inside Pulse nightclub have now, with a few exceptions, been made public. For months, media organisations were locked in a legal battle to get those recordings released. Previously on this show, we've talked about the arguments made by media organisations for releasing those calls. On 90.7 News, we've held back from broadcasting audio except where we believe it helps tell the story of what happened during the shooting and how authorities responded. Well, today we are going to play some tape from those calls just to illustrate how dispatchers responded to the shooting. We want to warn you now that this content may be disturbing to some of our listeners. With me in the studio is Intersection's Brendan Byrne. He's been listening to the calls and building a timeline of how this crisis unfolded. Thanks for joining us, Brendan.
My pleasure, Matt.
Joining us from California is Rachel Herron. She was a dispatcher for police and fire for 17 years in the Bay Area. Thank you so much for joining us, Rachel.
Glad to be here.
And 911 dispatch trainer Chris Knight joins us from Salt Lake City. He's Chief of Program Management and Implementations at Priority Dispatch. He was the director of the Florida Highway Patrol from 2001 to 2007. Chris, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, Brendan, let me start with you. You've spent several hours listening to 911 calls from inside the nightclub in the early hours of June 12th. Some of these calls were pretty long. What kind of picture did it paint for you of the role of dispatchers in this crisis?
Well, Matt, as all of this information was slowly released over the past 6 months, we've seen, you know, written recordings, we've seen body camera footage, and now we have the full amount of the calls to 911. And it just kind of paints that the grim and chaotic event that was happening inside that club. But in this last batch of calls that was released after multiple media organizations sued the city of Orlando, the keeper of these calls, the one that stood out was a call that was an hour and a half long, and it was made from a caller that was in the bathroom during the hostage situation. Mm-hmm. So this is that call that lasted an hour and a half. The caller is in the bathroom waiting for help to arrive. Now, the dispatcher, Joe, spends most of the call telling him help is on the way and to stay calm. Here's a little bit of that call.
All right, let me know if you hear anything else, okay?
Okay.
You know, you're keeping really calm. You're doing great.
Thank you. Best of the comments. Okay, we got it. We made it. We'll be okay.
So that portion of the call happened at about 4:10 a.m., so that's 2 hours after the first shots were fired, and still another hour before they would be rescued by first responders. Now, once law enforcement made a plan to breach that wall and rescue the hostages, it was up to Joe to kind of communicate what was about to happen and what he needed them to do. Let's take a listen to that.
Okay, guys, I need you to listen very carefully, okay? They're going to send off that charge. They are going to be entering. They're going to be entering a room. Not sure if it's going to be the bathroom you're in, but if the officers come in,
when you get down,
I need everyone to do exactly what the officers tell you to do. If they tell you to get down, get down. If they tell you to put your hands up,
put your hands up. Do whatever the officer do when they're coming.
And as that hour and a half call comes to a conclusion, Matt, you hear the explosions, you hear the responders breach the wall, and we assume that we hear Joe's caller finally does make it out of that bathroom.
Now, this call, as you were saying, was about 4 a.m, so a couple of hours after this crisis first started. What strikes me about this is the calmness in his voice.
Yeah, and that's something you kind of hear when you listen to all of these dispatchers, is they're very methodical, they've got a job to do, and they do stay very calm. And Joe, specifically in this call, he's trying to reassure the person on the other end, and he says, I need you to remain calm. I need you to keep the people around you calm, keep them talking. He does, in my opinion, a phenomenal job at calming him down and keeping everyone level-headed.
Well, Rachel Herron, let me bring you into this conversation. Put us in the 911 dispatcher's seat. What did you hear in that little piece of those couple of pieces of tape we just played?
It's interesting. I can hear the phones ringing behind him. And the thing that we have to remember about Joe is that he's literally doing 50 different things while he's talking to that particular reporting party. While he's calming the reporting party and passing that information on, he's probably also using another pedal to talk to either personnel in the street or the people that he's working with in the communication center. He's multitasking at a super, super high level. And it's funny, if you're in a dispatch center, you'll hear a dispatcher yell something at their partner mm-hmm. that needs to get done while their mute switch is on so the caller can't hear it. And then you'll turn your mute switch off and come back and say, you're doing a great job, ma'am. We're almost there. You're going to have to unlock the door. So the whole goal is to keep the chaos away from the caller managing to manage the situation.
So what you're saying, Rachel, is there's some chaos going on, or if you were to step into the call center, it would sound a lot different from, you know, maybe what the caller is hearing or what these recordings are telling us.
Yeah, it would sound insane. The thing about an emergency like that is not just one person calls, everybody calls. So Joe is very much stuck on that line. That's a very important phone call. He needs to keep open. That line of communication is essential. That means that however many other dispatchers are with him in the center, say there's 8 or 9 of them, they're having to answer the thousands of phone calls and prioritize them and triage them, keeping the ones that matter and getting rid of, letting go of all the calls who are saying the same thing. I think I heard gunshots. I've heard that someone's dead. There's someone, you know, if the caller is not actually with someone who needs help, the other dispatchers must let that go and continue to coordinate the units arriving to the field.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chris Knight, let me bring you into the conversation. What do you hear in that call? You work on protocols for 911 dispatches. Where does this kind of fit into that set of protocols?
I heard a very professionally handled call due to the length of it also. And as Rachel said, I agree with her 100%. A call taker is multitasking. A call taker dispatcher is multitasking, and people don't realize what they're doing in the communication center. There's a lot of moving parts, if you will, especially in a situation like an active assailant or active shooter, as he was dealing with there. What he was doing, he was giving instructions to the caller and giving him information to pass on to those others that were in that bathroom with him on what was going to happen when the police department entered the building. So pre-arrival instructions, post-dispatch instructions, whatever we want to call them, the call taker did a phenomenal job of telling them what was going to happen next, so the caller and those with him were prepared for that in that situation.
Chris, just how common is it for 911 dispatchers like Joe, who we just listened to in that piece of tape, to have had experience of a mass casualty, let alone a mass shooting?
Well, ironically, that is not the norm for our call takers nationwide. Yes, in a situation like an active assailant, active shooter, for the volume of calls that come into the Orlando Comp Center, to the state of Florida, nationwide, all 50 states and actually worldwide, An active shooter situation is not the norm. So a call taker, if you will, or a dispatcher can work an entire 25, 30-year career and never ever take that call because they are not that frequent. When they do happen, that the publicity that surrounds them, rightfully so, they're publicized for days, weeks, second-guessing how the call is processed and so forth by people that can actually listen to it afterward. And the bottom line is when that call comes in, the call taker, what they've got to realize is that person's affected by what's going on also. So if somebody's never processed that call before and they have a number of years as a call taker or dispatcher, and that's the first time they ever took it, the expectations would be handled professionally, competently, and the caller gets the help he or she needs. In this particular case, I thought the call taker did a phenomenal job on telling what was going on, but also what people have to realize is that's not the norm. If it's something we do on a call taker does on a routine basis, yes, they know exactly how to handle that, but if they don't do it on a routine basis, it goes back to their training. It goes back to how they prepared or how they're prepared by their agency to handle a call like this. He did an excellent job.
Chris, we're going to talk a little bit more about how call takers process this kind of traumatic event. But before we do, I just want to ask you too, I mean, with people trapped in this nightclub as they waited for law enforcement, how does that change the role of the 911 dispatcher? I'm wondering if they then have to employ other skills to talk them through that, just because it's such a long call and you know, they are really a lifeline for these people on the other end of the phone.
Absolutely. And you heard it from the call taker here. He used calming techniques, and he was explaining what was going on and so forth. And that's all just reassurance, if you will, to the caller that's calling in. And call takers and dispatchers do that on a daily basis on every call. They let the caller know what's going on every call. So nationwide, our call takers do a phenomenal job. In a situation like an active assailant, active shooter, they actually step it up. They step it up and do the job that's expected of them by the public.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking about what the 911 dispatchers went through and how they handled the Pulse nightclub shooting. Brendan Byrne, let me come back to you. What else did these tapes reveal to you about the shooting and the response?
Well, if we step back to earlier in the night, the dispatchers, they're not trying to keep people calm at this point. They're actually trying to figure out what's going on. So they're intelligence gatherers at this time, but they still want to make sure that the people that they're talking to remain safe. So they're kind of riding this fine line between finding out information but not putting the caller in danger. And here's a call from earlier in the night. This is around 2:19, so just a few moments after the last round of shots was fired in the club. Let's take a listen to that call.
Okay. Are you able to peek out the door at all? Don't do it if you're not feeling safe.
I don't feel safe.
Don't do it then. Stay where you're at. I've got description exactly where you guys are at, so they know where to come get you.
So we hear that dispatcher trying to get a description of the shooter, but it's not safe for the caller. Now, at that moment, SWAT begins to breach the club. And again, like we heard with Joe, this particular dispatcher is explaining what's going to happen. Let's give that a listen.
Okay, they're going to knock on the door and say they're the police, and I'm going to let you know whether it's them or not in order to answer. Otherwise, stay quiet, because we don't know who it is.
So what are you hearing in that piece of tape, Chris Knight?
I'm hearing the call taker do a great job of explaining what's going to happen, as I said before. And what we've got to realize is not only is the call taker or the dispatcher taking care, if you will, of the caller and telling them what's going to happen, they're also gathering information and hearing what's in the background for the responding officers. That's a big piece of it also. The responding officers have to know what they're going into and have to know what's going on at the scene at that particular time. So that call taker in that particular situation, not only doing the calming techniques and so forth and keeping that caller fully informed on what's going on, they're also listening to the background or trying to gather information to pass on to the responders that are on the way to the scene or have already arrived there.
Chris Knight, you train 911 dispatchers. I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of how mass shootings might have changed the way that training is done, and if so, how?
Well, ironically, what happens is law enforcement knows what to do when they get there. We train for it. We do the scenario practice. But sometimes what happens in an organization through no intent is the communication center, I don't want to say is left out, but maybe we don't put as much emphasis on that. So now nationwide, what's happening for events like this is there's training scenarios and so forth that people go through, that our communication centers go through and all the personnel. But a training scenario is not like a real live event. I said it earlier, anybody's going to be affected like an event like an active shooter. Anybody's going to be affected. So when a call taker hears the shooting in the background, as Rachel said, the volume of calls that are coming in a call center is just overwhelming, and naturally they can't answer all the calls, and the call taker has to know exactly when I'm not getting good information or can I get better information off another caller that's calling in. They got to make that determination on their own when to disconnect, if you will, with the call and move on to another caller so they can get better information, maybe like a suspect description or how many shots are fired or the shots still continue to be fired and things like that. So that's how they're trained nowadays. That's how call takers are trained nowadays to handle those situations professionally, competently, and in a manner that's expected of them by the public and by their agency. They do a great job.
And Matt, another thing that complicated things from that night that we saw in the transcripts from the first moments of that is this was Latin night. This was a Latino group of people that were at the club, and there were some people that didn't speak English. So these dispatchers had to connect with the call and then call a translator service and kind of translate. So you kind of see these layers of difficulties and challenges that the dispatchers have as the night went on.
Mm-hmm. Rachel Heron, let me come back to you. We've heard some tape from two parts of this long and traumatic night in Orlando. What's it like for a dispatcher? The adrenaline must be running pretty high when you start getting those calls. And I guess for these folks, when they realize the scale of this crisis.
Yeah, the adrenaline management is really something that makes or breaks a dispatcher. You don't get through training if you don't have this very kind of strange ability to lower your adrenaline when something incredibly scary happens. If you pick up the phone and you hear a gunshot and you know that someone has just died or is killing someone, the natural human response is to hang up that phone. You don't want to listen to that. And just like when a building is on fire, the natural human response is to run away from it, whereas firefighters are trained to run toward it. So when a dispatcher answers that call, you can often feel your heart rate drop and actually slow down. As you start thinking faster and faster, your brain speeds up. Like Chris said, there is training, but it is hard. It's impossible to train for every single scenario. And what that means is when you are in some kind of huge incident that is just beginning, everything that you do is creative. As a dispatcher, I was thinking when Joe's been talking to that guy for a couple of hours, keeping that line open, that man's cell phone, you know, would have died by then. People don't think about that kind of thing. That's the thing that the dispatcher goes, okay, you're going to need to find power for your cell phone. Do you have a charger on your person? If you don't have a charger on your person, how about somebody else in the room? Does the woman over there, does she have a charger in her purse? Can you plug that into the wall right now so that we don't lose you?
Mm-hmm.
Just the creativity that has to start flowing while you're maintaining your own adrenaline management is huge, and I think they're doing just a great job.
And if I can jump in, Matt, that did happen in that hour and a half call. The battery was ticking down, and so Joe had to coordinate with him and say, is there anyone else in that bathroom that has a battery? Okay, how much percent do they have? And halfway through the call, they end up switching to another mm-hmm. person's phone in there, and he's just, call back, call 911, ask for Joe. I'm here, I'm waiting for your call. And they end up making that switch halfway through the call.
Mm-hmm. Rachel Heron,
awesome.
What was the toughest call you had to take in your 17 years as a dispatcher?
Oh, the toughest call, and I don't want to upset anyone, but I did take the baby calls are always the hardest, and I took a CPR call of a man who was giving CPR to his baby who wasn't breathing. But the problem is the fire department was about 25 minutes away because they lived far, far in the hills, and that was the fastest service that they could get. So this man did 25 minutes CPR on his baby, and both of us knew that the baby wasn't going to make it. And that was a call I really I'm very good at letting go of all calls. I just don't think about them afterwards, but that one has never left me.
Well, with that in mind then, I mean, these dispatchers, for Pulse at least, they must be going through something fairly traumatic right now. I mean, after taking people through that night, being with them through that event on the phone, how do you think they might be coping with it?
What their agency will probably do for them is what's called a debriefing. Which is where everybody involved in the incident, all the dispatchers who are on duty, the firefighters, the police officers, hopefully get to come into one room. You go around the room starting from the point of the first call. So normally it's a dispatcher that starts talking to start these debriefings. And you get to look at the entire incident from everybody's viewpoint. That is, I think, a critical and essential thing to do after a traumatic event like this. However, the truth of it is that if a dispatcher came to work 3 hours into the Pulse nightclub shooting incident, and she's got to work 12 hours, you know, 6 or 7 hours later, she's exhausted. She's completely traumatized. Most of the incident is over, but she still has to keep answering the phone and giving CPR instructions to the older man who fell across town. She has to answer the phone and send the police to the abandoned vehicle complaint that has prompted a fight between neighbors. For dispatchers, there's really no break. So you do have to take care of yourself outside the industry. You have to get good sleep and eat right and exercise, because it can be very dispiriting.
Well, Rachel Heron is a 17-year veteran of 911 dispatching. Thank you so much for joining us, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Knight is a former leader of the Florida Highway Patrol. He now trains dispatchers. He's with the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you.
And Brendan Byrne is Intersection's producer. Thank you so much, Brendan.
My pleasure, Matt.
Still to come on Intersection, Terry DiCarlo, director of the Center in Orlando, joins us to talk about how the center responded in the aftermath of the shooting and what work is still to be done. We're back in a minute and we're taking your calls. Tell us how you think the city has changed in the 6 months since June 12th. We're at 1-866-338-5252 when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. On Monday, it'll be 6 months since the shooting at Pulse Nightclub. 90.7 News has been reporting on this story since day one, and today we're taking a look at how the city rallied after the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Joining us in the studio is Terry DiCarlo. He's the director of the Center. It's the hub of the GLBT community in Orlando. You'll see it where a rainbow flag flies on Mills Avenue. Now, after the shooting, the center became a rallying point for the community, a triage center, as the GLBT residents tried to make sense of all of this. Terry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The wider community was looking for answers too, and they still are. We want to hear from you. What did you see that gave you hope in the days and months after the shooting? Has the city changed since then? If so, how? And what's the best way to commemorate those who died and help the survivors? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Terry DiCarlo, earlier in the show, we heard from some veteran 911 dispatchers talking about how people in that role train and prepare for the kinds of calls they got on June 12th. Many news organizations aired those calls soon after they were released by the city. Did you hear how that's affected friends, families, survivors?
Sure. You know, I had a very hard time when those calls were released. We had, family members and survivors who have gone through one of the worst tragedies in history, lived through it and were just starting their healing process. And then were taken back to that night all over again by those recordings being played mm-hmm. on TV and radio. You know, I got a call from the police department the first time the calls were going to be released. It was about a couple hours before they were going to be released, and they said, we're just giving you a heads up that we're releasing these calls. So that gave us a little bit of leeway that we put out on social media. We tweeted out and we put on Facebook that the calls are going to be released. Please, you know, if you don't want to hear, please turn off the news. Turn off your radio, go to the Disney Channel or something like that, because these are being released. Mm-hmm. And we had one mom who was this was the second round of calls that were released, who was – she had lost her daughter. And she was making dinner, and she just had the TV on in the background. And the news came on, and she hadn't realized they were releasing the calls. And all of a sudden, she heard – you know, the calls coming through and the people on the phone. And again, it took her right back. And, you know, the healing that she was doing went right away, and it was like starting all over again.
In the last 6 months from day one, I imagine a lot of what you were doing was kind of practical, helping people get information, on-the-spot counseling, that kind of thing. Do you feel like the center is the role, the position of the center in the city of Orlando has changed in the last 6 months?
Very much. I always say the center is not the same place it was 6 months ago. You know, we were the first on the scene down at Pulse. We were there to comfort, to help, and to disseminate as much information as possible, and to not let anybody lose focus that this was an LGBT nightclub. And there were LGBT people on the floor. It was Latin night. Many of those in the club almost 80%, were Latino. And we couldn't let anybody forget that and try and politicize what was going on in any which way. They tried to, but I think we did a good job on keeping the focus on Latino, LGBT, and letting everybody know that this happened to our community.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the kind of counseling then that happens at the center. We were talking before off air, and you said you now have 2 full-time counseling staff, and you do it 5 days a week, and that's a bit of a change too.
That's correct. Yeah, we used to do, as people would need help, they would call the center. We'd give them the number of a counselor, and they'd call and make an appointment, and then they'd meet up. That's changed now. We now have, through a couple of grants that we were able to get, we now have counselors 5 days a week at the center, and it's on a drop-in basis. So you don't need to make an appointment. You can walk in the front door and say, hey, I just need to speak to somebody. And people are using it. We're really happy with the outcome so far.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be pulse related. It can be anything that anybody's going through. I had a 13-year-old transgender girl come in just the other day with her mom. And they needed to speak to somebody. And one of our counselors was right there to help. So, they're there every single day. And if somebody needs help, we just say, walk on in and say, I need help.
How did the girl you're talking about, how did she find out about the center?
Through a friend. It was funny because the mother had a friend who said, this is what my daughter's going through. And she really needs to speak to somebody. And he happened to know of the center. And he said, you know what? The center has counselors there. Let me call Terry. And he did. He called and he said, look, I've got this going on. I said, have her call me immediately. She called and we put the mom on the phone with the counselor. And the counselor said, I'll be right here waiting for you.
Mm-hmm.
And in they walked and walked right in.
Is just out of interest, I mean, the age range of folks who turn to you people, has that changed as well in the 6 months since Pulse?
No, the center's always been open to everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really, really has. I think people are utilizing the center more. You know, where we used to see, 5,000 people a month through our doors, now we're seeing about 7,500 through our doors. So I think more and more people know of the center, know what we do, and are coming by.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With us in the studio, Terry DiCarlo. He's the director of the Center for GLBT in Orlando. You can call in. We're talking about the 6 months since Pulse, how the city has changed. Maybe sources you turn to for help, 1-866-338-5252, 1-866-338-5252. Share your stories, 1-866-338-5252. You can also send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. Terry, I'm wondering too, I mean, the things in the immediate aftermath of Pulse were pretty chaotic, I imagine. You said also that you had some 600 volunteers on site at one point. How do you deal with that influx of people?
It was a very, as you can imagine, hectic and trying morning. We, and when I say we, I talk about my husband of 20 years and myself, got a phone call very early in the morning. And all we heard was that there was a shooting down at Pulse. We got out of bed and went down that way. And quickly, once we got down there, realized what was going on. My board president, amazing man, made his way to the center to get the doors open. By the time he got there, people were already waiting at the center. And within the first couple of hours, the numbers went from 100 to 200 to 400 to 600 people. And a line of cars around the center of people just wanting to donate, whether it be money, whether it be water, whether it be whatever. People just needed a place to go. They were part of this, and they needed to be around people, whether it was to help, whether it was to donate, or whether it was just to get a hug.
Mm-hmm.
And to be with others who were feeling the way that they were. And that's what the center became that morning, was a safe place and a place where the community could rally. They couldn't go down to the site, and they weren't quite sure where to go, and they came our way. And we opened the doors. We threw open the doors, and we're ready for them.
things have changed for you personally too, right? You were on the point of moving on to another job and leaving the city, and obviously you're still here.
Right. Yeah, I had already accepted a position with an organization out of Miami. And my last day at the center was going to be the Friday after Pulse. And, of course, then Pulse happened. I had originally called the company that accepted the position and said, look, I'm going to have to put this off for a month or two because of what happened. And they said that's not a problem at all. And they were working towards that next date that I was going to come with them. And just got so entrenched and met some incredible people, families, survivors, people like that, and got entrenched in their lives and got so involved that my heart just wouldn't let me go. And I called them and said, guys, I'm going to have to rescind. And they said, we sort of saw this coming, and we understand completely.
Talk to me a little bit, Terry DiCarlo, about some of the practical stuff you've been doing. You're essentially putting together a manual, if you will, of how to deal with something like this to the best of your ability. Tell me about that.
You know, we talk about how this happens so quick, and there really is no blueprint when something like this happens. It happens so fast. There was no manual to open up and say, okay, we've got to put this in place, this in place, this in place. There was nothing like that. So with everything that we did, we're downloading from our brains, you know, okay, we had an incredible woman, Lindsay Kincaid, who took on the counseling and got 600 counselors either on planes or on their way to Orlando, and then dispatched them to schools or colleges or churches, wherever that this could possibly be needed. You know, we got a whole social media team together, sat them in a room, and they started getting correct information out to people. You know, and then the other things that happen with the survivors, what do they need? What do these families need? You know, we looked to, we actually got a phone call. I was on my cell phone about 3 hours into Pulse from American Airlines. And they said, do you have an Advantage Miles account? And when I said no, they said, stay on the phone. We're setting you one up. And within 3 hours, we had 2.5 million Sky Miles in that account. And they said, fly who you need to fly. It's things like that you don't think of. You know, like I said, many of the people in there were Latino. They were from other places. Their families were from there. So, you know, it was a matter of, okay, how do we get mom and dad here? We didn't have to worry about that anymore. We had those miles. They could call. We booked them on planes and got them here. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the manual is still being written to this day because things still keep happening. So we'll have that together soon and be able to distribute. You know, like I said to you before, we know this is going to happen again. We don't know where. We don't know when. It could be LGBT. Maybe it's not LGBT. But if we were able to put this together and give it to other cities of what happened here and what we did and what the city did, maybe we can help those cities and say, okay, we need to be prepared for this.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. Terry DiCarlo, director of the center, is with us. If you've got a question for Terry, you can call us 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Terry DiCarlo, leaders in law enforcement, churches, the LGBT community, I mean, they're going to be trained to help anyone suffering from depression and PTSD. Do you see a need for those services?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We have one police officer in general. There's many of them, but one in general who's not come back to work because his PTSD is so bad. He was one of the first that went into the club. Those services are so needed. That's why we're doing the counseling at the center. The American Counseling Association has put together free counseling. It's something that's going to go on, and I keep saying 3, 5, 7, 10 years. Once you go through something like that, you're traumatized, and it doesn't go away in a month, in 2 months. It takes a lot. Mm-hmm. So They're going, yeah, it's something that's definitely, definitely needed. And I think with ourselves in the city and the other organizations, we're definitely working towards that.
Does it feel to you, Terry DiCarlo, that things have slowed down to the point where you can step back and reflect on things? Or are you still kind of, is your brain still going a million miles an hour trying to keep up with things?
You know, it's funny. I say it's 6 months this coming Monday, and it feels like one long day. You know, because we are there. We live it. We are, you know, we're with the families. We're with the survivors. So to us, it still feels like a long day. I see the city healing. It's taking, they're healing slowly. We'll see a lot of people come out this Monday for the anniversary, the 6 month anniversary. The city has become a different place. The city has become a hugging city. You know, you walk in somewhere and people really don't shake hands anymore. They say, no, I'm a hugger, and they'll give you a hug. And, yeah, you know, people have really – the city's become a loving city. Not that it wasn't before, but even more so now.
That's got to be heartening for you.
It is. It really is. You know, we were over at Universal Studios the other night for the first night of the Macy's parade, and it was my husband and myself and two good friends, and we were walking towards the parade, and a gentleman just out of the blue walked up to me and stopped me and said, "You know, I'm a straight ally, and I just want to say thank you for everything you've done and continue to do to help the families, the survivors in the city," and then gave me a hug and walked away back to his wife. And I stood there stunned a little bit. You know, I always get taken aback by something like that. But that's how it's become, mm-hmm. You know, where people are there and they'll just come up and say, hi, you know, thank you. What can we do to help?
So the center has become the place where people go to, you know, to get that hug, whether it's a real hug or a metaphorical hug. But I want to ask you, too, about the side of the nightclub. Now, we learned this week that the owner, Barbara Poma, decided she doesn't want to sell that to the city. After all, she feels a need to transform that site into a memorial herself. Mm-hmm. What do you want to see happen there, and how important do you think that place is for a place to people to pay their respects and that sort of thing?
I think Barbara's going to do it right. She's going to take input from survivors, from family members, from the city, from community leaders, and from the community at large, and decide what should happen on that property. She's an amazing woman, and I know that she will make the right decision with the input of everybody that she's looking to. I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't think anybody knows what it's going to look like. It's going to take some time, and for her to get that input from those people, for her to say, okay, this is what I've settled on. So we'll see. It's going to be a while. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a while, but we will see what her plan is.
Were you surprised when you heard the news that she decided not to sell it to the city?
No, not really. Knowing Barbara and knowing what an incredible person and where, you know, you have to remember why she opened that club and why it was named Pulse. It meant so much to her. So she followed her heart, and that's all one can do. And, you know, there was an offer on the table, and she went with her heart rather than that offer.
Mm-hmm. About 30 seconds left here, Terry, but what's in the future for the center here? Things have changed, obviously, in the last 6 months. What does it look like 6 months from now?
Well, within the next month, our redone building will be open. So we then put our current location under construction and attach the two buildings. So we're growing even stronger. We're growing even bigger. I'm adding so many programs. I've got a legal clinic starting in January. And again, we're going to do the same. We're going to put it out to the community and say, what programs do you feel you need? And start those. I've hired 4 people within just the past couple of months, so we're growing like crazy.
Well, Terry DiCarlo is the Executive Director of the Centre. It's a focal point for the GLBT community in Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us,
Thank
Terry.
Thank you so much.
Up next, an encore performance by D'Andrea Pelletier, the Opera Realtor. Intersection continues in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. D'Andrea Pelletier performs as the Opera Realtor. Last year, D'Andrea joined us to perform some of her favorite holiday arias. This is an encore performance.
When I was 10, I started playing the violin, and when I started playing, I heard this aria, and it was beautiful, and I didn't know what it was, but I hummed it all the time, and then I finally heard someone sing it. It was Puccini, O mio bambino caro, and I said, I want to sing that. I want that. And I just fell in love with it, and we had an opera singer come to visit my high school, and after that it was solid. I just knew I wanted to sing. So I did it at Valencia, and then I did it at UCF too.
And you've pursued a career in real estate, though, too. Are you able to make the two things mesh together?
Surprisingly, yes. It was just by proxy, because I come from a family of realtors. My mom is an awesome real estate agent, and so I was her assistant for about 10 years. And then once I graduated, I just said, you know what, I'm going to do this. And I kept trying to figure out a way to integrate both. And my husband actually came up with the Opera Realtor. He said, it's actually pretty perfect. No one has it, which is why it's so perfect for using as a niche, which is good in real estate. You have to have a niche.
Now, when you're showing houses, do you kind of check out the acoustics? Do you ever kind of have a surreptitious sing when the house is empty?
As cliche as it is, yes, I do. Before my clients come in, I actually go in, and if it's a high rise, I love it. I go in and I just belt a really high note, and hopefully the neighbors don't hear, but I do it all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The first song I want to sing is Ave Maria. In this version, I don't hear often, so I wanted to learn how to sing it, because everyone sings a traditional version of Schubert. So instead, I wanted to do the Bach Gounod version, and it's significant to me because I actually sang this for my husband's grandmother, and she begged me to sing it for years, and then I didn't, and she passed away, so at our funeral, I sang it, and so I love to sing it now.
Okay.
So this song has significance to you, D'Andrea Pelletier. Is this a song you'll hear at Christmas time typically?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I learned the Jewel version years ago, and so I play it. And now that I sing it often, my family actually likes this version a lot, so they play it too.
Now, you want to sing another song for us? What's the next song you'd like to sing?
This is Summertime from the opera Porgy and Bess by George Gershwin. And funny, I had to learn this song within, I think, 2 days, the first time I heard it. And I had always wanted to. And now when I hear it, I just get so excited because I think of my kids. It's talking about having your kids take off. And your mom is good. Your dad is good. You're going to be good, too. And you're just going to take off and spread your wings, like the song says. So it's an American one, which is what I love about this opera.
That was D'Andrea Pelletier performing Summertime from the opera Porgy and Bess by George Gershwin. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne, technical direction from Nicole Darden-Creston. Our intern is Talia Blake. The executive producer is Catherine Welch, production assistants for this week's show from Abe Abariah. You can find this show and previous episodes on our website, wmfe.org, or wherever you download your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening. Thank you.